Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All right, we're going to do the first single from the record, which is called People Get Old. This is my pal Mark Arelli over here singing and playing with me today. So here it is, People Get Old.
Someone said youth is wasted on the young. Spilled every last drop of time last summer in the sun. My daddy had a Timex watch, cigarette in his hand and a mouthful of scotch. Spinning me around like a tilted world on his arm. Houses need paint, winters bring snow. Your kids come on in before your supper gets cold. Collection plates and daddy's billfold, and that's how it goes. You live long enough, people get old. I sat up proud beside him in the cab of that truck. Going 30 miles an hour down a side road, talking about the fish we caught. And I'm older now than he was then. If I could go back in time, I would in a second. To his beat up blue jeans and a t-shirt with the sleeves cut off. Houses need paint, winters bring snow. Kids growing up and sneaking out the window. Hitting every small town dirt road, and that's how it goes. Live long enough, people get old. Yeah, people get old. Daddy keeps busy in the afternoons playing cards by himself. And he shouldn't be shoveling that first snow, but you know he won't take the help. For the bride and love, he don't say too much, but hell, he never did. If you still think he's 45, and he still thinks that you're a kid. Well, one day you find yourself saying the things they said. You'll be walking down the hallway, turning off every light switch. You twirl your kids in your arms. Before you know it, won't take too long. They'll be running off, making a life just like you did. Houses need paint, winters bring snow. Nothing says love like a band of gold. Babies grow up and houses get sold, and that's how it goes. Time is a thief. Pain is a gift, the past is a past, it is what it is. Every line on your face tells a story somebody knows. It's just how it goes. You live long enough, the people you love get old.
Thank you. Welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat Podcast. Gary Trask, Billboard Senior Director of Charts.
And hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
So last week on the podcast, we had Grammy Award winner Richard Marx. This week, we're just making this, you got to win a Grammy Award to get on the podcast lately. Lori McKenna is our special guest this week, who you just heard open the podcast. That was Lori doing People Get Old from her new album, The Tree. Released last Friday, July 20th. Great performance by Lori. She's coming up here on the podcast this week as our special guest. She's written some huge country hits in recent years. Humble and Kind for Tim McGraw. She co-wrote Girl Crush for Little Big Town. Carrie Underwood's current hit, Cry Pretty. So we're going to talk to Lori coming up. Another song on the way. Talking about Richard Marx, Trevor, interesting timing. So we interviewed Richard in June. We posted the podcast with him last Thursday, July 19th. July 18th, the day before, he tweeted in response to Trump. He said, I misspoke. I meant to say I wouldn't be right here waiting for you. And got up to 260,000 likes since then. So the day before the podcast posted, that tweet came out, absolutely blew up afterwards. So, interesting time, I guess, right? We had him on at the time when all of a sudden that day everybody was talking about him. Was it the tweet or was it the podcast?
If I had to be a betting man, I'm going to say it was probably the tweet. Yeah. Of course, you know, in this moment, all things Trump, good and or bad, get a lot of traction and no exception here.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I thought, oh, you know, we're going back to 1988. I'm not sure, you know, younger fans really know everything about him. But as it worked out, everybody was talking about him that day.
It's one of those songs that, like, even if you don't know Richard Marx, you know, is the architect behind it. I mean, I feel like you hear that song, you know, just it's somehow been continually synced in commercials or TV shows or even just like kind of the melody is like, I don't know, almost like one of the ones that you feel like a lot of people in high school talent shows or like high school like choir like no, it's just like a very standard, might be too sort of generous a word, or maybe that, you know, or too.
You mean Red Hair Waiting, right?
Yeah. Even if you don't know, you know it. You know it.
All right. So Richard Marx last week, Lori McKenna this week. Again, she's coming up as our special guest. Taylor Weatherby from the Billboard editorial department. She's going to join us on that interview coming up too. But first, this week's Billboard Hot 100's Top 10.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
God's plan.
Number 10.
I can't do this on my own. Hey, nope. Someone watching this shit close. Yup, yeah, close. I've been me since Scarlet Row. Hey, bro.
Damn, I be going psycho. Little mama bad like Michael. Can't really trust nobody with all this jewelry on you. My roof look like a no-so. Got diamonds by the bolo. Come with the Tony Romo for clowns and all.
Number 8.
Thinking of you in my bed. You were my
ever. Number 5.
It just won't stop. It go
that's
a real
number 4.
Your reflection without a follow, without a mention. You really piping up. You gotta be nice for what to these niggas, I understand. You gotta
need a girl like you, yeah, yeah. Number 3.
I need a girl like you. Maybe it's 6:45. Maybe I'm better.
I need the dollars.
Number 2.
Beat it up like a yacht. Start a job.
1. Writing?
Say you never ever leave from beside me, cause I want you and I need you, and I'm down for you always. KB, do you love me? Are you riding? Say you never ever leave.
All right, last week we saw Drake make his return to number one, and he's not going anywhere this week. That is In My Feelings once again, number one this week on the Billboard Hot 100. Of course, as everybody knows, In My Feelings, driven by the incredibly huge viral dance, which seemed to be extinct for a while there, but has been revived in 2018. In particular, this one thanks to Shiggy, who started off that dance craze for In My Feelings. And I mean, it's blown up ever since. Plenty of celebrities are doing it. In the past couple of weeks, I think Will Smith has had really one of the best ones. In Budapest, he was on top of the Chain Bridge, got a little drone out. Like, you could see the whole city landscape. If you haven't seen the clip, it's actually pretty sick. Check that one out.
He was getting Shiggy with it.
Okay. All right. The man has never met a pun he couldn't enjoy. Yeah, but Will Smith has done it. Ciara, Russell Wilson have done it as well. I mean, Odell Beckham Jr. did one of the early ones. I mean, everybody's doing it at this point. And because everybody's doing it, that means that song is getting a lot of online action and the streams are getting huge. How huge? We're talking record-breaking huge. This week, In My Feelings, posts 116 million streams for the week. Is that right?
Yeah.
116 million. So that's the biggest week that our friends at Nielsen Music have ever recorded for any song. That even outdoes the almighty Harlem Shake back in 2013. Everyone remembers how big that was, thanks to similar circumstance. Obviously, all the clips of everybody, you know, the swim team doing it underwater, the whoever, whichever, everybody did the Harlem Shake. Don't act like you didn't try it, because you know you did. But In My Feelings has surpassed that. And of course, we've really seen Drake be a monster with streaming, really, throughout every step of his career. But particularly this year, it just feels like it's taken on a whole new level. Just when you thought Drake really couldn't get any bigger.
Yeah.
I mean, this has by far got to be his biggest career year. We've seen, you know, God's Plan and obviously Nice for What. I mean, both of those had huge music videos as well. But In My Feelings, you know, not Drake's music video that may be coming. But again, videos are just making these numbers balloon like crazy.
Yeah, when you think of what he already did with God's Plan, 11 weeks at number one, and the Nice for What, and now this, or really, I guess, getting into the conversation about halfway through the year, is this the greatest year ever for any artist, ever on the Hot 100? It's only July, but look what he's done so far, and now adds this record this week.
Maybe. I mean, I guess that's a really tough thing to drill down. I mean, because I guess there's a lot of ways you can look at it, but I mean, if it's not the almighty one, I'm sure people will think all the way back to, well, Beatles 64 when right. they, you know, exploded, or even some of the Bee Gees years or things like that. But it's got to make the short list. That is without a doubt. And like you said, we're not even done yet. There's supposedly an In My Feelings, an actual video from Drake coming.
Right.
And we're not sure if it might incorporate the challenge in some way or not. But, you know, I mean, we're just locked and loaded, and we still have, I mean, what, 20 more Scorpion tracks to pick from? This is not over yet.
All right. From all that to an artist who actually jokes that, totally joking that she'll have a dance album at some point, because she is a total Americana folk singer-songwriter that's been her sound for a long time. And actually, in recent years, she's having some of her biggest successes ever so far. So I mentioned earlier, Lori McKenna wrote Tim McGraw's Humble and Kind, number one hit on Billboard's country charts, Girl Crush, Little Big Town, huge number one country hit as well, her current hit that she co-wrote with Carrie Underwood, and other writers that we'll talk about coming up, Cry Pretty for Carrie Underwood. So Lori McKenna has become really one of the premier writers of country hits, along with her own music that she's been releasing. Her latest album, again, is The Tree, is released last Friday, July 20th. So you heard the first single at the start of the podcast, People Get Old. Another song is coming up, but we're going to talk to Lori now on the podcast. We're going to bring in Taylor Weatherby from the Billboard edit department. Huge country fan. Writes a lot of our country stories on billboard.com. So, yeah, really excited to have Lori McKenna, our special guest, on this week's Billboard Sharpie podcast.
Houses need rain. Winters bring snow. Kids, come on in before your supper gets cold. Collection plates and daddy's billfold. And that's how it goes. Live long enough. People get old.
Thanks for having me.
You were just saying you've been in a van for the last few hours. You came in from Boston last night.
Yeah, we had the Boston CD release show last night, so we drove in early this morning. And I haven't been in the middle of a minivan for 4 hours in a while, so it was good. It's a good way to spend the morning. So I'm happy to be here.
All right, we'll wake you up after a whole long drive. I'm probably going to alienate Trevor and Taylor a little bit at first, but you're from Stoughton, Massachusetts. Right. I'm from Braintree.
We probably played each other in football at some point.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I'm sure Gary was on the team.
Thank you for thinking I could be a football player.
Quarterbacking and all.
There's not much of a country scene in Massachusetts, you would think. There's a big folk scene with Passim and Cambridge, but did that influence you at all growing up, whether the folk scene in Boston, or you just happened to be, that's where you're from, and songwriting?
Well, I mean, I sort of came up, I guess, in the folk scene there, but Boston, as you know, has a really good live music scene. And my songs sort of, you know, are more domesticated or sort of stay in that simple mode, and I think that lends itself to country music. So when I ended up sort of involved in country music, it was through a publishing deal, writing songs. But I didn't grow up on country music. But there's a huge scene in Boston. We have two country radio stations, right. And so there's a lot of it now. But I think, you know, 12 years ago when I started doing that side of what I do, there wasn't so much of it.
And you go to Nashville a lot, right?
I do, about twice a month, yeah.
All right, you guys can chime in, because Taylor, you go to Nashville. Trevor, you went to school there. No more Massachusetts talk for now.
No more lobster rolls.
Well, I feel like your voice like tends to country, though. It's like, I mean, not that you need to alienate yourself into one genre, but I feel like it works so flawlessly. Did you not really like see that when you were starting out songwriting? Did you think that country would be something that you'd pursue?
I didn't think of it really, honestly, in that way. I think the way that my voice is sort of unique, you know, sort of in a way, but when I first started recording, like the first records I made, is when I really realized how bad my accent was. And the producer would come back and be like, "Do you know that you don't pronounce any of your R's?" Or like, and I was like, "R's? What?" You know, like my accent, but like if you go back and listen, I really had to learn how to pronounce all my words, and I had to learn via singing. So I sort of have developed a little bit of a southern twang singing now, because that's how I learned to. I couldn't figure out how to make the words all make sense to people unless I got out of my Stoughton accent. I think I had a pretty solid Stoughton accent.
I'm not sure
on.
I've ever heard a Boston accent or like a Massachusetts accent in a song before.
It's like how,
like,
British people don't sound British when they sing.
Yeah. I think I may.
she found the lane.
She originated the Boston country scene.
Yeah. No, I didn't. But it just sort of, you know, it's like evolved over time. But when I started traveling, it was really, I didn't know that everybody didn't talk like, you know, like we do in Boston until I started going a little west of here, you know.
That
so,
is so funny.
It's crazy.
Well, now I'm trying to find a title that you've written that would have like car in it or something.
I stay away from words.
Yeah, right.
That's why I say kitchen. There's no R's in that word at all.
You started professionally songwriting. Was age 27 when you already had three kids and you were married? I know you'd been writing before then, but was there a process that took maybe a little bit longer than you might have expected?
Well, I just didn't think I would do it. I just didn't know, you know, how to. I didn't really grow up with people that were musicians. I have two brothers that are songwriters, but they're like, you know, wrote songs at home and, you know, weren't sharing them really with the world. So I just never thought I would really have the opportunity to do it. And so when I think I started open mics when I was around 27, 28, and when I got out and I saw a piece of that Boston music scene and how nurturing it is, and really it's a great little world, and you know, we played Boston last night and I told the audience, like, if I didn't start there, I don't know if I would have ever left my house, because the confidence at that point, but there was not a lot of confidence going on. Like, could I really do this, or is this something that other people will want to hear? I wasn't sure. And so it really took the audiences in Boston to sort of give me the confidence that I needed to just keep going and keep. I knew I loved writing songs, but I didn't know anybody would like to hear them. You don't know that necessarily.
Is songwriting one of those things, you know, for artists in particular, you almost can't be an artist without listening to other artists, getting influenced by them, hearing what's out there. For songwriting, for you, was that something that you developed on your own and something that you just really personally owned? Or did you hear other songwriters, hear that some other influences around the time that influenced your decision to start writing?
Yeah, well, I grew up on singer-songwriters, you know, like James Taylor. I always say, like, James Taylor was like Elvis, and, you know, in my house, like, Jesus and James Taylor is how we grew up. And
side by side.
Yeah, it's just like Neil Young and Carole King and Carly Simon, and I grew up with that music. And I knew, I guess, my brothers would, you know, like, the guy singing this wrote this song, you know, like, from a very young age. And that's always really what I was drawn to, is that type of music. So I started writing songs when I was 13, because that was my vehicle of, like, you know, expressing emotions rather than, like, a diary or a journal like a lot of people have. And I had no intention of sharing ever, because I didn't think I could. So I wrote songs for years that I thought nobody would ever hear. So my editing process, I think, is a little different than some people's because of all those years of just writing songs just for myself. It's a very selfish way of songwriting.
Did that lull at all while you were, like, dealing with young kids?
No, I actually started writing more when my kids were little, because I was home, and my sort of schedule was different then, because I would write a lot when I was putting them, I would sing them to sleep, and then I would just sit in their room, you know what I mean, and on the floor, you know, and I probably started writing much more once I had the kids. My kids were a big part of, like, my whole story, because I don't think I would have ever stepped out of my house with music if I didn't have my kids already to sort, like, I knew where my heart was, so I knew if I did step out with music and everyone's like, you're terrible, go back home, I wouldn't have, you know, it wouldn't have, you know, broken me in half, because I had so much already at home with those babies. So
would you ever put those older songs on an album? If there's something you thought was so good you wrote when you were 18, 19, and you know, maybe this would fit on my new album, or is it, this is who you are now, so you're only going to put newer songs? I always wonder, when artists have these huge back catalogs, that maybe people haven't heard some of these songs. What do you do with some of those?
Well, usually, I'd have to go back and listen. It's hard for me to, I always want to write another song, because I love the songwriting piece so much. Like, my friends get mad at me. They're like, let's record this one. And I'm like, can't we just write another one? Like, I always want to move forward. And, you know, a songwriter's favorite song is usually the last one they wrote. And that's kind of how that goes. But so songs are tough for me. Like, we, at meet and greet and stuff, sometimes we'll play an older song from my catalog that I almost literally have to relearn, because people will ask me to play it. I'm like, that one? It's so old. And so I'm always wanting it. It is hard for me to sort of go back to that stuff and listen.
When it's hot, eat a root beer popsicle. Shut off the AC and roll the windows down. Let the summer sun shine. Always stay humble and kind.
I feel like you're really known for your storytelling and your detail. And does that just come natural? Or do you write a song and go back and say, you know, I need something a little more specific to put in here? And I started with the Americana Convention in 2016 in Nashville. And you were on a panel with, I think it was Radney Foster. Mm-hmm. You guys were talking about songwriting, and the term furniture came up in songs, of how those are the little things you put in songs that really, I guess, the more detailed the song becomes, the more universal it is. And, you know, I go back to Root Beer Popsicle and Humble and Kind. It's just something that it's so specific, but everyone can kind of relate to it. Is that, when you write, do those things just pop into your head, or do you go back and say, you know, I think I need a little something more specific?
Well, usually when we get there, and I think furniture is like a little bit of a Nashville term now. Like, a co-writer will say, let's throw some furniture, or let's keep it like, the first verse has more furniture, let's throw some more furniture back in here, which sounds like such a funny term, but it is, and it is, you know, a metaphor, but it's also like literal too. Like, sometimes I think it's really a great way to paint a picture is to show you what the room looks like, so the listener can sort of either place themselves there or finish the rest of the story. And I think those little details, you know, when you string them together, allows the listener to, you could see it one way and I could see it a different way. And then you could see, like, it allows the listener to sort of be more involved in their version of what's happening in the song. And I don't think I did that, like, I thought that when I was 13 or something. I think I just always was, you know, they always say write what you know. So it's like, I did, you know, I'm not like a worldly person. So I'm always like writing about I always write about the kitchen because so much takes place there. We have so many, you know, conversations and things that happen to us standing in our kitchen. So I think I've over the years, I've grown to sort of love that sort of trick in songwriting and sort of like drawing out the picture and letting the listener place themselves.
And going back to starting songwriting so young and now, and then going professional with it at 27, how did you end up like forming your craft on your own? Like, how did you become a songwriter and actually feel confident in what you were writing? You know what I mean? Like, how were you writing these songs and actually feeling like they were something?
Well, that's part of my journey too, is like that confidence. You know, it started, you know, it was a really slow walk really to get to the point where I could share songs with people. And I wrote by myself for so long, and it wasn't until I had a publishing deal that I started co-writing. So by that point I was, I think, 34 before I ever co-wrote a song. So I had all those years of just doing it alone. Once I started co-writing, I really discovered that I love that process. I love sort of bouncing off another person, an idea. And I guess it's because I'm the youngest of six kids, but I'm not sort of like, if I know something isn't right, but I think that I might, if I say it out loud wrong, it might make you think of the right thing. So I guess I'm not like embarrassed about being like, this is dumb, but could it be this? And then, you know, your co-writer would be like, oh no, but that is dumb, but this is right. And then it gets you there. Like, I sort of like, I learned to write. I spent so many years alone co-writing, even though it was later on, it was at 34. I learned to write so much more once I started co-writing.
So when you were on your own writing these songs, what were you using to kind of help you grow as a songwriter? What do you think it was that helped you kind of hone in on what you actually wanted to say? And, you know, don't have people to bounce off of, like, how are you doing that?
It was probably a lot of self-absorbed things that nobody really would want to hear now. And it was probably a lot of stealing from, you know, movies and books and things like the way we tell stories now is just like sort of like stealing those little pieces of people's lives and trying to make a whole little 3-minute story out of it.
So as a songwriter, I feel like with any creative art, you can always kind of tinker with it and toy with it just forever and ever. How do you know when a song is done?
Yeah, I don't tinker that much. I have friends that will go back like for a month and go back and like rewrite lines and things like that. And I'm always like, well, let's just write a different song. I'm not very good at going back and editing things once the moment is over and I have the song. I will sit there until, and sometimes if I'm by myself, it is a couple of days. But for the most part, I will sit there for a day and get it structured down. And if I can't get it, I will put it aside. I almost never go back to those things. But I'm not that precious about it, I don't think. I sort of think it's 3.5 minutes and I didn't get it right in this song, so I'll just try it again and try to get it right in the next one. And I don't know. I think if I was sort of more trying to be more perfect about it, I would probably be in trouble. I'd probably make myself crazy.
I never thought of it. Like, I always assumed it would be, you know, I guess especially if you know it's supposed to be a major record on a major label, you'd kind of want to toy with it. But I like that it just, you either really feel it or you don't. And, you know, if this isn't the one, we can start over, you know. Because, you know, I feel like for so many people, especially in pop music, they think that if it's going to be a big top 40 song, it has to be, you know, we have to figure out this exact word. We have to sort of put this science, almost like refrigerator magnets, and put it together. It's just great to know that, you know, and the flip side, in the country sphere especially, you know, you can have these same major hits that are, you know, critically, commercially adored that can actually just be organic. And maybe we didn't get it right this first time. We don't have to sit here and, it's got to work. It's got to work. Yeah. You know, that's great.
I'm really not that good. Sometimes a co-writer will be a little bit more that way. Mm-hmm. And that those are like sometimes hard days, but they're really fun days. Like I always say, like every co-write I've ever had, like maybe I didn't get the best song out of it, but I always learn something, whether it's something you learn about my own deficiencies as a writer, or something I have to grow at, or learn something about music, you know. And sometimes I will end up with somebody that is sort of sees it more mathematically than I do, say. And those are always fun days, because then I get so much out of it by just seeing the way their brain works, because mine is sort of working the opposite.
I read that you always start off usually trying to start with the title of the song. Where do those titles come from? I think that's a very interesting place to start. Like, most people might start with the hook or something, but yeah, you have an idea for the title.
Those are used, like, Humble and Kind, I had the title first, and Girl Crush, which was not, like, I said that title, and Hillary Lindsay sang the first four lines of that song, so I didn't come up with the concept, I just had the title. But I do like titles, like starting with titles, especially in co-write situations, because it's kind of like, it's the first line's always the hardest, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like breaking the ice, like, let's start here. But they can kind of come from anywhere, and like, I always tease and say, you know, if you're dealing with a songwriter, you can kind of see a look on a songwriter's face if you say something and then they, like, they have to check their phone, yeah, or something. Like, yeah, that's, they're probably writing down got what you just little, said. Yeah. So, speaker, that little glossy, like, I have to just check my phone for a second. And then,
do you have, like, a list of, like, working titles?
Yeah. I think every songwriter, if you, like, pick up their phone, there's, like, a note with, like, millions of, you know, or sometimes it'll be written down on a piece of paper, but everyone sort of has that running list, I think.
Careful when you're talking to a songwriter. They're going to take something you say, and it's going to be in the top 40 hit.
Yeah, right.
If it's another songwriter, and what, like, you know, like, we'll be like, we should write that. But if it's, you know,
what, songwriter's
if my husband
courtesy
says it, it's all mine, you know?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold the door, say please, say thank you. Don't steal, don't cheat, and don't lie. I know you got mountains to climb, but
well, let's go song by song. By your three of your biggest hits, I really just want to dig into each one. We're talking about "Humble and Kind," Grammy Award winner for Best Song, 2017.
Where do you keep the Grammy? Always got to ask.
Oh, it's actually on the piano in our living room. So.
Does it have a "Do Not Touch" little thing by it?
No, no.
So people that come by.
I was gonna say no pressure for the guests who just want to play along. You know.
No, it's they're pretty good. Everyone's pretty good about it. You know, they drank champagne out of it and all that stuff, so they don't. I can't impress my children at all, or their friends. They're like, they could care less.
Grammy, whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
Are they not country fans?
No, they are. They love music. It's just that it's me. So
they have to know their mom is like way more badass than so many moms out there. Like, moms are all great, but you have a Grammy.
I'm
so
telling, not just one.
Not just one.
Right. Maybe it's because the second one. Yeah.
Mom, Miss McKenna won another Grammy. Cool. Great.
Did you write that song at your dining room in Stone?
I did. Yeah.
So just popped into your head. The title came first and the whole idea. How did it come about?
Yeah, it just was, you know, I dropped the kids off at school and I came back home. And if I'm by myself, a lot of times I will stay. My writing room is in my basement, but I'll stay just in the dining room and hang out and do laundry in between verses and things. And that was just came from a list of things I was thinking, like, you know, I have to make sure I tell my kids all these things, and thinking about the things that my husband and I would both want to make sure they know. You know, we left this morning, and I have all these sticky notes that I leave, you know, like put the dishes in the dishwasher and stuff like that. And my friend Mark Arelli is traveling, my guitar player and dear friend band leader is traveling. He came in the house and he saw all the sticky notes. He's like, there they are. So I always write all these things down when I'm traveling, and nobody sees the notes. I get home and they're like, oh, did you leave a note? I'm like, yeah, it's right there. Oh, I didn't see it. So I figured I'm just going to write it all down.
Well, it has to be pretty cool for you as someone who started out writing by yourself for so long to now have a song that's so iconic that you wrote by yourself, because you have, you know, your team of songwriters and all the people that you've collaborated with, but now you have a song that is so well known that you wrote by yourself. Did that feel pretty full circle for you?
Yeah, I mean, that song's just been such a blessing to all of us, you know, in my family, and the kids knew it was their song, and I still see it as this little, it's a very simple song. Everything rhymes with the word kind. It's like a three chord progression. It's, you know, it's very, even the words, obviously, my youngest was 10 at the time, so it's like you think of all the things you repeat over and over again to little kids, like, hold the door, I say please. So it's like there's so much just simplicity in that song. I saw it as such a, like a little prayer for them to carry around. And then when Tim McGraw got it, he just saw it as such a bigger picture. And it still blows my mind. You know, it's still like, I still see it differently than he does, but I think it's amazing that he had the ability and the talent to do, to just make it into such a big moment in all of our lives, really.
It's got to be crazy to see a song that you wrote and that means so much to you personally be performed by one of the biggest country acts, you know, and like seeing him connect. You said he took it in a way that you didn't even imagine. So it's like, it's got to be really cool to see someone like that, and just any singer that takes a song that you wrote, apply their story to it, and then see how it impacts people outside of like your control, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to even describe the feeling. I have this picture that my friend Becky Fluke took, because I opened one of the Soul to Soul shows last summer in Boston, and so all my family was there in one of those, you know, boxes watching the show. And when Tim, you know, I made sure that I was up there with them when Tim sang Humble and Kind, and Becky took this picture of just all of us, you know, just like holding each other, listening to the song. And it's really, you know, there's so much pride for me in that song, but also just the fact that the biggest blessing is that my kids really know. Sorry. That it's their song.
Yeah.
That's really sweet.
Now you get me crying.
Sorry. Didn't mean for that to happen. See, they think you're cool.
No, I don't know.
I got a girl crush. Hate to admit it, but I got a heart rush. It's slowing down.
Let's talk about Girl Crush. Little Big Town, your first Grammy Award winner, which you wrote with Liz Rose and Hillary Lindsay. So
right.
different dynamic for that. I think at this point, its legacy is that it's sort of become this controversial kind of a song. In Nashville, it didn't go to number one on the country airplay chart. It was a huge number one on the sales streaming airplay chart overall. But there were a lot of stories at the time about how country radio was a little nervous, some stations, about playing it. Did people misinterpret it? What's your take on all of this?
Yeah, it's so funny watching that song, you know, from the minute it came to life. So like I said a little bit earlier, was I had that title in my phone, you know, with all my titles. And I said it to Hillary and Liz. And I said, hey, I want to write a song called Girl Crush. And Hillary had a guitar in her lap and she sang the first four lines of the song. And she said, you mean like that? And I looked at Liz and we were like, yeah, sure, that's what we mean. But there was, honest to God, there was no discussion. Like, there wasn't like, I think it should be conceptually like this, and we can, you know, sort of, there was no discussion. The song came out of, like I always say, it came out of her face just like that, and she always laughs at me because obviously it came out of her mouth, but it just like came out of her body in that form. And I always say, like, songs sometimes know better than we do. We think we have an idea for a song or we have a title, but we don't know what it means. And sometimes if you give it that moment and you just give it that time to have a voice, it sounds weird, but they really will guide you if you follow them, if you follow closely along. And that one just, I wish so much I had a video or a recording of that moment, because that's exactly what happened. And it was really an example of a magical moment in a co-writing experience. So once that was our, those four lines, you know, form where that song's going to go, and we just chased it in until it was done. And we knew it was weird. We didn't know if it made 100% sense, because sometimes when you're in a room writing a song, we all know what we're talking about, but will a listener be able to come in and get it right away? So we send it to Liz's son, Scott Ponce, who's her publisher. And he's like, I totally get it. So we knew one guy got it. We're like, okay, it makes sense enough. And then later on that day, Karen Fairchild and Kimberly Schlepman showed up at like 11 a.m. And they said, what have you been writing? And we're like, well, hey, we wrote this. And they really did know right away that they wanted it. The controversy, the radio, you know, I don't think it was ever going to be a single when they were cutting it. I don't think that song was like cut to be a single. But then when people heard the record, they were talking about the song. And then I think just maybe in Nashville, that sort of, you know, sort of like we had other writers texting us and being like, that song's so cool. Like that twist is like somebody hasn't, you know, it hasn't been done yet. It's so hard to find something that hadn't been done yet. And it found us. Like, we didn't really find it. It kind of found us, or it found Hillary anyway. And so when they did release it as a single, and that whole talk about, can we play this on the radio? For us, it was really like, honestly, a 2-day problem where we didn't know if people understood it. And then there was talk about, well, maybe they'll have to pull it from radio, but it sort of cleared itself up really quickly. And it kind of became more about, sort of what are we playing, a little bit more of a radio discussion than it did about a lyrical song. Like, to me as a writer, if I had an argument for that, it would be like, why are we not listening to a whole song anymore? Why do we only listen to a verse and a chorus, right, and think we know that song? And maybe we do have to listen to the whole songs before we judge them.
Right, a lot of it seemed to on people not understanding.
Yeah, they just weren't listening to the whole thing, perhaps. And so, so it's funny because there was a lot of different little pieces to it, but it sort of all cleared itself up over a couple of days. And then we saw the Nashville community really come together. Like, they made the hats, and the Girl Crush hats were everywhere, and our songwriter peers and friends were, you know, we're standing up for the song that they, you know, that they believed in. And Little Big Town and their team, of course, were amazing. And it was a little bit of a moment, a hiccup in a beautiful story of us. You know, when you have a song like that, you really spend the year with that song, because then there's award shows and watching the band, you know, perform it. And it's still, you know, it's a great experience for me, because it was my first time at the Grammys, and I got to experience it with Liz and Hillary, who some of my dearest friends, and we love Little Big Town so much. So,
and then you won, so your first and time then we at the went Grammys, home with the Grammys. You're like, well, this is what the Grammys are like, right? Yeah.
Well, it was funny because that day, so we wrote that at like 8:30 in the morning, and then Karen and Kimberly came over at 11. We wrote three other songs with them that day. So the five of us wrote three other songs that day. And there was a moment in that day where I was looking around the room and I realized, with Liz Rose and Hillary Lindsay, Karen Fairchild, Kimberly Schlepman, that I was the only one that didn't have a Grammy.
Oh, no.
I don't know why I thought that. But I'm like looking at them all and I'm like, I'm the only one here without a Grammy. Like, I felt so sorry for myself. And had no reference to Girl Crush at all. Karen Fairchild said, Laurie McKenna, we're going to get you a Grammy.
No way.
I swear to God.
That is the coolest thing.
She did. It was such a day.
You should have tested them and been like, girl crush, go. What does that sound like to you? Because Hillary just made it seem so easy.
I know. It was just a great moment. And we wrote Tumble and Fall that day, which they recorded. And I think maybe we were in that land, you know, like, let's get this. And this will, you know. But she did. They made it happen, so.
Well, and I want to go on a little bit of a tangent because the co-writers on that song are Hillary Lindsay and Liz Rose, who are the Love Junkies, and I feel like a lot of people that aren't in the country community don't really know, if you were to tell them the Love Junkies, like, what is that? But in the country community, it's like, holy crap, they're like the most iconic women team like in country. So how did you guys first meet, and how did you kind of decide that you wanted to form this little trio, or like that you knew that you worked together so well? Just kind of the background of the Love Junkies and where the name came from.
You know, I don't know what the name. I think I was in the bathroom when the name started, but we came together because Liz Rose was one of the first people I ever co-wrote. She sort of was one of the early writers that taught me how to co-write songs. So when I started coming to Nashville, and I still do, I would stay with her. I just stay at her house, and she, you know, just became a fast friend as soon as I met her. And she was one of the first people I met in that town. And Hillary, I had written with, just the two of us, over the years, and Liz had written with her. I think they have a Taylor Swift song together. You know what I mean? Like, she had written, they had written together, but the three of us hadn't written together. So our publishers decided, oh, we should just have them write for 3 days at a time, because Laurie comes in for 3 days at a time. She stays at Liz's, so they can just write. Just instead of breaking up the days, just put the three of them together for the 3 days. And the first song we wrote together was Sober, which Little Big Town cut. And there was some sort of rhyme scenario that was happening in the, where we had a rhyme with something that, junkie, or, I don't know, like it came up somehow in the writing of that song. And so, I think it was Liz was like, we should have a name, and you know, and so Love Junkies was our, but we were kidding around, you know, just totally joking around. But by that point, you know, but each time we'd get together like every other month, and we'd write so many songs, like some trips would, in 3 days would write 9 songs, you know what I mean, or 8 songs, and we had so many songs. And then together as a little team, it just became easy to just call ourselves, instead of writing all three names across the top of the paper, it just came easier to call ourselves the Love Junkies. And we love each other, and we write from the minute we wake up in the morning until one of us falls asleep.
And those are like songwriter sleepovers, is what I heard that you guys call them, right?
Yeah. And it's there's wine sometimes involved, which is fun because I'm the one with the computer. Like, I have to have everything in front of me written down, and the two of them are more like everything's just in, like, Hillary can remember the whole song just in the air as you're writing, which blows my mind, but she can. And Liz has a notebook, and so she's writing things, but not really the whole thing. And we write so much sometimes that the next morning Liz will wake up and say, what did we do yesterday? And I'll start taking, I'm like, we did that. She's like, really?
You're like the group secretary. I am.
I'm like, I'm trying to earn my keep. Like, if I'm not going to have magic come through me the way Hillary can, I better write it all down.
So did the weekend that you guys wrote Girl Crush together feel like more, not special, but just like, did it feel like there was something in the air or something?
Well, anytime we're with Karen and Kimberly, we always have a great time anyway. But when we're with, they're kind of like our extra Love Junkies, you know what I mean? So when that was just a great day anyway. And I think we wrote that day until 1 o'clock in the morning. Like, we just, like, you know, sometimes it's like, if you know there's nothing else going on and you're just in this house together with guitars and food and wine, and everyone's talking about everything that's going on in their lives, like, those are always great days anyway. Yeah. But sometimes in the morning I'll be like, did you remember we started this one? And we're like, oh God.
Are you ever able to sort of like turn the songwriting machine off, like if you go on vacation or something, but you get inspired by something? Are you like, oh, like, I didn't want to think about it and work, but like I have to because I just saw this story or this image or this title came to me, or is it something that's just always going?
I don't think that you ever want to try to turn it off. I mean, the bigger problem would be like if you just don't have any ideas, right, to write about. So I think like any writer is probably always trying to keep a little bit of a log of things that they want to write about someday. But I don't write every day. Like a lot of my friends in Nashville will, they write every day. And I have gotten to the point where like, okay, I cannot write a song today. Like I need today to just be a regular day without trying to rhyme words. But for the most part, I don't write as that often. I only like maybe try to sit down two or three times a week to write. So, and I might not get a song. Like sometimes I check every guitar in my house and there's just not a song there. So I don't really ever get to the point where I just can't write another one, you know? And I think it's because I don't live in Nashville. I live in Boston. If I lived in Nashville, I would want to write a song every day because there's so many songwriters there. And I think then I would get to the point where I would need a break, you know what I mean? Just from overwriting. But I really don't overwrite. I might not write enough. I don't know. But I haven't hit that wall yet.
I love that line. I checked every guitar in my house, and sometimes there's not a song there. I love how you literally have to find it. That's great.
Yeah, because sometimes one guitar might have it, but the you know, and like they sound differently. I can't play the piano either, but I will sit down at the piano. On desperate days, I will sit down at the piano.
We just need a title for that. Then it becomes a song. Check every guitar.
Right.
Is that the title?
Yeah. To go over chopsticks.
This is how it starts. Right. See?
I just want co-writing credit, and we're good, you know?
We don't have Grammys either, so we feel
right.
Yeah. Okay.
Not just you.
We're going to work on this together.
Where do you keep the Girl Crush Grammy? Is that on the piano as well?
So, yeah, they're all on the piano together with the CMAs and the ACM. Well, so, yeah.
I just heard them all. They want to be together.
Okay. I have this one more Grammy question. Since you won back-to-back years, did you expect that you could win the second year? Or did you think that, I just won last year, they're not going to give it to me again? Or did you kind of know going in based on the reception of the song and all the attention it got?
I don't think you can ever really know with something like that. The Grammys are such it's you know, sort of a different world than like the Nashville, you know, award show world. It's like, it's everything, you know, all genres of music. So it's a really different award show. But yeah, I think that in cases like that, you have to be prepared just in case so you don't, like, you know, you have to have something in your brain. But I was up for four Grammys that year, and I lost three of them. So, I mean, I knew there was going to be losing something was going to go in with that. But that Humble and Kind was up against Die a Happy Man, which was the biggest song of the year. So I really didn't know. I don't even know what I said when I got up there, to be honest, because it's still crazy to me that any of this has happened.
Do you feel like an impact on the types of rooms you're getting in for songwriting, like co-writes or anything, since winning a Grammy, like the first Grammy, or maybe even having two to your name? Do you feel like it's changed your career at all?
I think that, like, those songs, you know, like when you have the song, like people might, like, because we always say, like, well, it's been discussed, and looking back, you remember the songs that are sort of nominated in that category more so like the ones that win, you know what I mean? Like, kind of like if you've been nominated, that's amazing, you know? So I think it's really more, rather than trophies sitting on a piano somewhere, it's really, you know, sort of your catalog of work that the more you go on, and when you have a song that works like that, or when you have a song that breaks through like Girl Crush, it's like, people know you for that. And also just Nashville is a very loyal town, and also just like being part of the community and them knowing that, you know, that you, when you show up, you know, you're there to write, and you know what I mean? That's a big part of it. The personal side of co-writing is really important to the Nashville community. Is a really big-hearted community where you can't just, like, you couldn't be not a nice person and make it very far.
You have to be humble and kind.
There you go. There's the lesson.
Sorry, I had to. I've been, like, waiting for that moment.
40 minutes in. She got it.
But the truth is, you can pretty lie and say it's okay. You can pretty smile and just walk away.
All right, the other song I wanted to ask is a current hit. It's your fifth top five hit on Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart as a writer. Cry Pretty by Carrie Underwood.
Yeah,
with the Love Junkies. Yay. And Carrie Underwood co-wrote it as well. Was that what was it like writing with Carrie on this specific song?
Yeah, so we came. That was a day, a Love Junkie day, where we were all at Liz's house, and Carrie came up to write with us. So she and I think that to your question earlier, like I think that's an example of her knowing the songs that we had written as a team, sort of together, and her saying, "Oh, I want to write with the Love Junkies. I'll just do what instead of them coming to me or whatever how she normally writes or us going to a studio, I'll just go up to Liz's house like everybody else does." And that was, we wrote a few songs that, well, it was a 2-day session, and I think we wrote maybe 3 songs or 4 songs, but that was the first one we wrote. And that was my first time writing with Carrie. She cut a Love Junkie song on her last record, and we got to sing with her a couple of years ago, and she's been great to us. And obviously Hillary is such a big part of Carrie's world because she wrote Jesus Take the Wheel, and she's had so many Carrie cuts, and they work together so well. That was a great day for me. Well, just getting to know Carrie a little bit better, but also I love the days where you have an artist in the room watching one of your co-writers sort of click with that artist. And that's when I sort of that's when I'm trying to steal ideas, like to learn, like what's the best way to write with an artist. And I've, like, when Barry Dean's in the room with me and an artist, I'm always like watching Barry to see his little tricks of how, you know, your job is to get the best song. Now the artist is in the room, and it has to come from that source. Because if the four of us are sitting together and I write a song about my husband, we write a song about my husband, it's not going to mean as much to the artist. That's, you know, it really has to come from that source. And so watching co-writers that are really good at bringing the best out of a big artist like that is really a fun day. And we just had a ball, and she's so beautiful, and she's such a great singer, and you always see her on TV, and everything's just so perfect about her. And I had only been around her during like TV performances, award shows, things like that. I think I had written with her one other time, and it was just great to have like a girl day hanging out with Carrie, talking about Whole Foods and stuff, and her kid, you know. It was like she wanted to be with us in that day, and that of just like really talking about our husbands and whatever, our kids and all that. And it was just like another girl sitting in the room, except she could sing like Carrie. And then that song came, and it was we didn't know it, you know, you never know if they're gonna cut it. Strangely enough, few months later, we were at Liz's house again, the three of us, just me and Liz and Hillary, and Hillary looks at her phone. She said, "Oh, Carrie just called me, like, I'll call her back." And we're like, "No, answer the phone, get the phone." And she's like, "No, I'll call her back, it's weird, I'm not gonna answer it, like, we're writing." And then she texts Hillary, and she said, "Call me when you can." And so we're like, "Just take a break and call her back." And so we hear Hillary in the other room, and she said, "Oh yeah, I'm with them right now." And Carrie said, "Put me on speaker." So Carrie knew we were together, the three of us together, and she waited to tell us that. It was like a nice surprise. So she waited till the three of us were together, and she got on speakerphone and said, "Cry Pretty's going to be the first single."
That's when you know you made it as a songwriter, when you can ignore a call from Carrie Underwood and call her later. Yeah,
isn't that a great example of a co-writer, like, just like owning the song? She's like, "I'll call her back later, it's okay, we're writing a song." And I think Carrie would appreciate that about Hillary, but yeah, that was so sweet, you know, like she waited until somebody said, "Oh well, they're doing Love Junkies, you know, next week, you should, you know, tell them then." And she called us and let us, we were shocked, we just didn't know, you know.
So it felt like
go ahead.
So it felt like a true collaboration with Carrie, where she's all over that
song.
She's
a great writer. She's a great writer. And I had known that from my friends that write a lot with her, like that have been with her since the beginning of her writing time, you know, like that she's grown so much as a writer. And you know, Liz and Hillary are among the best writers you could ever write with, and she's right up there. She's a great, you know, sometimes when you're in a room with someone like that, you're like, "Well, I don't know what they need me for," but Mm-hmm. And she's another one that hears all the notes. Like, she knows all the notes. And it's so fun to be in a room with somebody like that.
Did the title come first on that one? Or where did the concept
Yeah,
for
I think that was a title out? Song.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was. And then Hillary, again, just starts singing. And I think that's a 6-8. That's like a 6-8 is like Hillary's lane as far as the right hand. And I think you can always tell when Hillary starts the song. And I think that's how that landed.
So what did Carrie bring to it then? Like, what you say, she's a great writer. So what did she kind of add to it that maybe wouldn't have happened if she wasn't there?
Well, really everything. And there's, you know, that's the thing about if I was going to write that same exact song alone, that song would have to stay in the space of my voice. But when you have Carrie there, her voice can kind of do anything. Hillary's too, and they have similar phrasing, and they you can tell that they've worked together a lot, and that they respect each other as singers. But the song, if even just the three of us tried to write that song without her, it would not have vocally ended up in the world that it's in, because that's how you can tell that she had so much of the melody, because my face would not have gone to those notes because my throat can't hit them, you know what I mean? So that's why it's fun to write with Little Big Town, because you write for the harmony. Like, if when you're writing with the whole band, they literally want to hold words and notes so they can, the four of them can harmonize. It's like a whole different, like, I've, you know, all the years I wrote by myself, I was never going to write a song that way.
Right.
So when you get in with a great singer like that, and you get in with, and the other thing about Carrie is she really knows what she wants to say. And thank God, because otherwise you're just guessing.
Were those yeahs, like, you know, the parts where she's like really going at it, was she just singing those in Liz's house?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. And there's also a weird part of that song. Mark would know how to explain this. It goes to like a strange chord, because Hillary doesn't know what she's playing. She bar chords everything, and she doesn't know what like key she's in, or she doesn't know the names of the chords, and she hit a wrong chord and went to fix it, and Carrie was like, no, I love that. And so now it's in the bridge of the song. It's so funny, because now when, like, it's like, if I had to play the song, I get it, like, I have to have a guitar player tell her, like, what is that chord that and she sings it in the bridge. You can hear it in the bridge, but normally we would have brushed past that, but Carrie was like, oh no, I love that. So it was like a happy mistake that, you know, ended up in the song.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time. This is one of the most fun chats we've ever had on the podcast, just getting into every in and out of where songs come from and that thought process.
Well,
so,
thanks for having me.
Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Well, here's what I know. Even when she's sleeping, she's still dreaming about you. That's the way that it goes. Even when she's laughing, part of her is worrying something she didn't do. She only sits for a minute, she's a hummingbird in a living room. She's a silhouette smiling with the weight of the world on her chest. She'll move a mountain for you by the afternoon. A mother never rests. She works in colors. It's her and the sun. Waking up early, bringing light to everyone. She's counting on angels. She's hoping they're there. But just in case, every time she says your name, it's like a little prayer. And there's wishing stars for the hurt and band-aids for how it feels. And the night lights on, so we even the sun gets to set. But she's a stubborn believer that time in a clean house is how you heal.
that's how it is. That's how it is, I guess. Well, here's what I know. Even when I'm sleeping, I'm still dreaming all about you.
And I didn't cry. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.